Today, AFP Audio is talking to Mr. Neil Wright, who's a vascular surgeon at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in the University of Adelaide. Welcome, Neil.
Hello, Carolyn. Thank you.
And Neil, along with Professor Rob Fittridge, is the author of an article that appears in the June 2013 edition of Australian Family Physician, Varicose Veins, Natural History, Assessment and Management. And I suppose the article starts by pointing out the spectrum of varicose veins ranges from telangiectasia through to reticular veins to varicose veins, and that they're more common than perhaps we once thought. The article talks about some of the changes in terminology and classification that have happened in regards to varicose veins recently. Can you just give us an outline of perhaps some of those?
Surely. There have been some anatomical changes where in order to remove a whole lot of uncertainty in terminology, the superficial femoral vein is now known as the femoral vein only, to try and remove that confusion. The old words long saphenous vein have been replaced by great saphenous vein, and the short saphenous vein has been replaced by the small saphenous vein. This is all an international sort of consensus terminology so that we all know which veins we're talking about, and we're all on the same page when it comes to describing veins. And then there's been some agreement on the size of the various veins, where telangiectasias are dilated intradermal venules, which are less than a millimeter in size, and reticular veins are non-palpable subdermal veins, 1 to 3 millimeters, and varicose veins are larger than that.
Excellent. And the other thing that the article mentioned is about the CEAP classification, which is Clinical Impact, Etiology, Anatomy and Pathophysiology. And Table 1 has the details of that, the clinical elements of that for GPs. But that might also be useful down the track when you're looking at comparing treatments and different types of veins.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the things that has developed bedeviled venous research and comparison across clinical trials in the last while has been the classification and measurement of outcomes. And the CEAP classification helps us to standardize what we're talking about in very clear terms, so that researchers can describe the veins very accurately and therefore categorize them properly when they are entering them into clinical studies. But it is also quite a useful tool for general practitioners who are trying to refer veins on in terms of giving good advice to patients according to which sort of classification they fall into.
Yeah. And Table 1 has the details there if people want to have a look at it. And I suppose one of the questions we often get asked by patients is, you know, why do I get varicose veins? What does the evidence actually say are some of the causes?
Yes, so my short sort of fairly flippant answer to that to most patients is, well, it's a combination of bad luck and bad genes. There is very little evidence for anything else. So we think that varicose veins come about because of a loss of connective tissue or breakdown of connective tissue, especially elastic and collagen tissue in the wall of the vein, which allows the vein to dilate, and that the incompetence of the valve is secondary to that. There must, however, be some patients who do have primary valve leaflet problems, and also patients who, a small number of patients who have secondary varicose veins where they get DVTs, and that causes valve problems. Certainly patients who stand a lot, who are obese, and certainly in pregnancy, these patients all can develop varicose veins, but whether that's the actual primary event or not is hard to know.
Yep. So the article then provides a bit more information for GPs on history and examination and makes the point that duplex ultrasound is the standard of care for investigation. If a patient comes to see you about varicose veins, what sort of factors come into your decision making about the need for management and management?
Quite a difficult initial discussion with the patient, certainly from the GP's point of view, where probably most varicose veins do not actually need treatment as such, simply because they don't cause much in the way of problems. And much of the emphasis, even in my consultation, will be, well, how do the veins bother you? And if they're not really bothering you at all as a patient, then it really isn't necessary to do anything. Because for most varicose veins, simply wearing elastic stockings some of the time should be enough to control most symptoms and avert most complications. There are a group of patients who have changes of chronic venous insufficiency, and these patients will benefit from an operation, even though it may not be causing them too much in the way of symptoms. So that's a discussion that may need to be had with the patient who's starting an early venous ulcer, has lipodermatosclerosis in the ankle, and you want that patient not to develop a venous ulcer at the end of the day. So you might offer those patients surgery even though their symptoms are not disabling. However, in between those two spectrums, there are a large group of patients who have cosmetic type varicose veins with a bit of heaviness or achiness of the legs after a long day standing, where treatment is neither essential, I tell them, and certainly not urgent. And I find that a lot of patients actually go away very reassured. So they've obviously come along worrying that they're going to get a DVT or worrying that they're going to get a venous ulcer. And just a sensible discussion on the natural history of the veins and telling the patient that wearing support stockings will avert most of those problems is usually enough to satisfy a large body of patients. There will be a group of patients who have already made up their mind about what they want before they even come to you. And I think one should give those patients what they want. If they're looking to have an operation or if they're looking to have laser or radio frequency done, then it would be very hard to deny them that course of treatment unless, of course, it's not clinically indicated.
Yep. And so it is quite a lot of people who I think probably get also told by people, oh, they look awful, you should talk to someone. Once they do find out, they're far reassured. But if people do need, I'll say, active management, there's quite a few treatment options out there. What does the literature tell us about the various treatment options?
We've had a plethora of trials recently which are now clearly showing equivalence between the endovenous methods of treatment and some of the mechanical methods of treatment compared with what used to be the gold standard, open surgery. We all know that open surgery is quite an aggressive thing to do to patients. So having a big groin incision or even a small groin incision these days does come with some negatives. So infection, lymph leaks, neuralgia, and some worse complications can follow. Deep vein thrombosis is perhaps a bit more common with open surgery. And the literature is really showing equivalence between the less invasive methods of treatment, including endovenous laser and radiofrequency ablation. So those two methods of treatment seem to be roughly equivalent to open surgery in terms of long-term outcomes, and we're talking 2 to 5 year outcomes now. The short-term outcomes are probably a little bit better than open surgery, because often it's an office-based procedure. So I think there's a very clear shift in thinking across the world to treating more and more veins with minimally invasive treatment. And if you ask me what I would like done if I had big varicose veins that needed some sort of treatment, I would definitely be looking at doing some sort of endovenous type of management.
Yep. And, I mean, the article makes the point that perhaps there's a group of people with very large veins or tortuous veins and things like that for whom other options might be better. Is that?
Yes.
But largely, the endoluminal option endovenous option seem to work as well, as you pointed out, in the short and now at least medium term.
Yeah.
For one of those, if a patient was to have sort of an endovenous thermal ablation, what you said it's a day procedure. What's the sort of aftercare type things that they need to be involved in?
Well, it's really very minimal, and there are many practitioners who are doing this as a lunchtime case. So the patient will come in, have a little bit of local anaesthetic, put on a compression stocking, and go back to work. So it really can be extremely minimally invasive if the patient chooses. Most patients will want to go home and spend the rest of the day or the following day with the leg elevated, because there'll be a bit of aching in the leg. But the majority of patients, after a few days, will be fully ambulant and really be able to carry on with their life.
Right, which, yes, is very different even to the improvements in the open surgery.
Although if you do have a well-motivated patient, they can be discharged the same day with open surgery.
Yep.
And will be able to go back to work after a day or two. Even with open surgery, the outcomes are much better. Clearly, there are a group of patients who don't want that and would prefer to spend some time off work. And for those, perhaps surgery might be a better option.
Okay. And I suppose the other sort of group of things are the injection sclerotherapies. Where do they fit in? Or are they as part of the endovenous as well?
Difficult to know at this stage, because we don't have great data on ultrasound-guided foam sclerotherapy. But definitely the short and long-term occlusion rates for foam sclerotherapy are not as good as open surgery or endovenous thermal methods. However, it is really minimally invasive, so it's really just an injection, and it is something that can be repeated multiple times and is definitely less expensive than the other options. So if someone really wanted to avoid any kind of major intervention, then ultrasound-guided foam sclerotherapy is a very, very good option. And the technique has been refined, the products have been refined. So it becomes quite a good option if you're trying to avoid a major intervention.
Yep, and it certainly gives the vascular surgeon quite a range of treatment options to offer to the patient if they're in a group that would benefit from treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has allowed the advent of the phlebologist as well. So you don't need to be a vascular surgeon to administer some of these treatments. Obviously, the vascular surgeons would like to keep this to themselves, but it's a fact that many phlebologists are doing this sort of work. And as long as they're properly trained and assess the patients thoroughly and work in concert with a vascular surgeon, there should be no objection to that.
Yep. And so finally, what would you see as a few key points GPs should have in mind when they're seeing patients with varicose veins?
I think good communication and good discussion is the key here. I think you need to try and find out what it is that the patient is bothered with, and you could probably avoid a lot of unnecessary referrals just by listening carefully to your patient and finding out what's concerning them, and you may well easily be able to provide the reassurance that they need without sending them further. Find a number of practitioners in your area who do good work and have good outcomes, and you use those practitioners who have experience, have done a lot of cases, and have good outcomes.
Excellent. Thank you very much for talking to us today. And I'll just remind people that we've been talking to Mr. Neil Wright, who is one of the authors of a June 2013 article on varicose veins. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Caroline.